This is Donald Smith. It is December the 18th, 2007. I'm here with Dr. Proctor, class of 1942, Dr. D.L. Proctor in Lexington, Kentucky. Dr. Proctor, it's great to see you again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Can you start by telling me how you got to become a veterinarian? Maybe talk a little bit about your father's practice and then how you went to undergraduate and then got to Cornell.
My father was a dyed-in-the-wool believer in physical diagnosis. And as such, even though he was doing small animal work in Macon, Georgia, he felt that he was qualified from his training as a pediatrician. So we moved from Macon, Georgia to Louisville to enter the medical school. And about that time, it was 1929, and the stock market collapsed. And financial necessity dictated that we moved to Lexington and open an equine practice, which was done in 1930. Dad was a great believer in keeping his youngsters busy, and I was his head gopher. He never had any trouble with me as a teenager staying out late, because I could stay out as late as I wanted to. But at 6 o'clock the next morning, I was supposed to be on the ground cleaning that practice car up and restocking it for the calls of the day. And got me started as far as having a work ethic. I was interested in veterinary medicine, but I really wanted to be an Army officer and was interested in flying, which I've carried on to this day, 3,000 hours. But I was colorblind, and the Navy wouldn't have me. So I finished up in veterinary medicine at Cornell, graduated in 42, and marked time doing the sprint test at Saratoga Raceway, and followed the thoroughbred races as a veterinarian at Detroit and Cleveland and Churchill Downs. And then I was called up, signed to a veterinary corps in Chicago, and from there we were posted to Fort Reno, Oklahoma, the biggest remount station with a population of about 5,000 mules and 10,000 horses. It was a great opportunity to go ahead and do surgery that was indicated without any constraints of the day, which would be mostly monetary. You couldn't do a very complete sterile operation on an animal that was worth $180, plus the fact that the Army was not interested in anything and wasn't physically able to do their job that they had in mind for them.
What conditions did you see in those mules and horses? What were you treating?
Sura was a big killer. That plus, you can imagine any kind of a shrapnel airburst, what chance a mule would have under those circumstances. And lacerations of a very little founder. There wasn't enough to eat. I never saw a case of tetanus while I was in the service because they had them all vaccinated. And this was something that tetanus was the greatest cause of death in horses.
How did you get overseas, and when was that?
It was in 1944, and we've had 39 months overseas. We were the headquarters troop and a veterinary contingent. It had nothing to do with the actual breaking of the horses. We simply took care of their problems. I think there were 6 officers and probably 25 men, and we were ordered to the New York Aerial Port of Embarkation at LaGuardia Field. And we were flown to Gander, and then to Azores, and then to Casablanca, Tripoli, Egypt, Cairo, and then to Abadan and Karachi, where we gathered ourselves together. And I took a 5-day train trip across India to Calcutta.
So the horses and mules came in, and you were responsible for doing what?
When an animal was presented to us from the Transportation Corps, it was our duty to break that animal so that he would be amenable to the job in the service that he was intended for, which was a pack animal. And so you had to teach them to allow you to put a heavy pack saddle on their back and then a load stand quality about where you've got the load on. The Westerners that have tried to tie a diamond hitch on a bucking horse will have some idea of our problem. And then we took them out on marches to keep them fit. It was a veterinarian's problem to assure that we took healthy, sound animals to the troops for use in combat.
And where did the horses and mules come from?
Well, they came from everywhere. We had the animals from New Zealand and Australia. There were some animals that had been on Guadalcanal. And, of course, they came from the States. New Orleans was a principal port of embarkation. And why, I don't know, because it seemed like California would be the obvious place to start out.
And they landed where?
Calcutta.
And how did they get them off the ships?
at Calcutta, they put them on the barges. I mean, they actually made a barge road to the bank. What we did learn the hard way, based on their experience in the islands, in the Solomons, was that these horses we knew would follow a bell mare or a bell. We finally just pushed a bunch of them overboard and let them swim ashore. And I don't think we ever lost one drowning. Some of the early ones started for Japan instead of Solomons, and we had to go out and round them up in a motorboat. I didn't actually take part in that.
You ended up doing some big game work later during the war. Tell us about that.
I was made commanding officer of a shipment point, and as such, I got to know some of the native people and the tea plant managers. And this tea plant manager called me and said that they had an elephant that had gone wild, and that he killed a couple of people and stomped up their rice paddies and pushed down their bashes, their houses, and would I could like to come up and do something about it. So I gathered up myself and a lieutenant from Brooklyn and an ex-jockey named Hunter, and the three of us intrepid hunters went elephant hunting. And lo and behold, we get on a very narrow path with grass higher than the elephant's head, we ran into him. He was coming our way. I shot him three times right between the eyes, and it didn't faze him.
What caliber?
That was with a Durand with armor-piercing bullets. And so then when he turned around, I put a couple more shots in where I thought his knee was. Then it got dark on us, and we went home and laid on our plans and borrowed a bigger caliber gun from a tea planter, and we were able to put the elephant down out of his misery with a shot behind the ear. Well, the cats were the same way. They were killing cattle. The tiger picture that I actually took part in, he had killed a couple of cattle. The native said, and I can believe it, that he took a grown cow by the neck and just threw her up over his shoulders and walked off with it. I don't know how much they weighed, but here was this beautiful specimen being carted away, and his head was dragging the ground. So I took my belt off and put it around his neck and up to a bamboo pole. They had him carrying it on a pole across her shoulder to keep his head out of the mud. But the whiskers were an ideal medicinal alternate therapy for sterility, and the Indian women would come up with firebrands and want to burn a whisker. If they could do that, they were assured that they would be reproducing. Anyway, we got the tiger and have a lovely picture of him.
Then after the war, what happened, Dr. Proctor? You came back to the U.S. when?
Yeah, I was in service for 39 months, and I felt like I, after a while, that even though I was able to hack up a lot of surgery at Fort Reno and Fort Clark and experience overseas, I felt that had given me a good background in animal control and the basic surgery. It gave me, above all, a great respect for the necessity for being clean. One cannot conduct sterilized operations unless it's clean to start with. But I came back and was able to fit into my father's practice.
Your dad was killed soon after you got back.
We had about 10 months together. He was driving, and they came down a hill. And there was a bridge at the bottom, and a Greyhound bus hit on.
So you took over his practice then?
Oh, yeah.
And you were a veterinarian for some pretty famous stables.
Yes, we've had some good ones. I didn't limit my practice to any one kind of animal. I was more or less at home with Tennessee walking horses and American saddle horses. Didn't do my polo or riding horse work. The standard bred and the Walden Hall farm had 2,000 acres. And Dixiana farm, C.B. Whitney, bigger places around here.
Claiborne Farms?
No, the Caswicks were there.
Tell me how you became a surgeon in the ACVS.
Well, I liked it. It was a challenge. Jack Jennings asked me to consider it. And I have never been an outstanding student, so it's been one of my lifetime happy thoughts is the fact that I was able to qualify 25 years after graduation. As you know, that's not an easy job.
How did you become involved with the AVMA? You became president.
Yeah, well, I was vice president when I was in school. I was a junior or so. So I just moved right in with it. We had Brud Tucker. He was president of the student AVMA, and I was vice president.
You have been very interested in the history of veterinary medicine in this country.
Well, it just seemed to me like you ought to know where you're coming from. I know I was amazed at the correlation between economics and where the profession flourished.
You've been very fond of Cornell over the years, haven't you?
Yes, it did great things for me, and above all is the prestige that you get from being associated with it.
Up in your surgical facility here on the farm, you developed that table, is that right?
Yeah. Well, it was obvious that you had to have the animal up and in a position where you could restrain him and have surgery. And because I had a bad back, I wanted one that I could raise or lower from a matter of inches. The Lang table, which was standard at Cornell in those days, and it turned over on a hinge. The main thing it was, it got the horse on the table, and you couldn't get up to the horse unless you crawled up on the table with him. So based on these conceptions, I got me a hydraulic hoist from a filling station, and I put a piece of stainless steel that was the proper length, but say 5 feet long, and they had a little pipe welded to them. And then I made a headboard that you could slide into the pipe, and that would be when they were flat, and you could turn it on either way. You could have a left lateral recumbency or right lateral recumbency, and then you could have a trough if you were going to do a throat surgery. And it was very good for belly surgeries. And helped with delivering foals lots of time because I controlled all this with an overhead hoist. And I think that today it's the best table. You know, we really were inventing as we went along based on experience, and usually it worked out very nicely. Vaughn was a great big friend of mine. We were a bunch of us sitting around, and some of these people were qualified. And I said, Tom, I'm disappointed in you. He said, what do you mean? I said, you left this place as a head surgeon, go up to be a dean. He said, I'm disappointed in you. I said, deans are a dime a dozen, but good equine surgeons are hard to find.
Well, Dr. Proctor, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
No problem at all.